podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Brighton Rock Podcast, the podcast about the beautiful club within the beautiful game. With me, Russell Guyver, and I'm going to be having some of my pod squad in for part two of this episode, where we'll be talking about the Stoke match. Yes, we're back on Zoom for the first time, what seems like quite a while. But the first part of this podcast, also on Zoom, is to welcome back to the podcast for, I think, the third, fourth time, something like that, Mr. Phil Annetts of FA Cup Fact File fame. That's quite a tongue twister, actually. I'm not saying that last bit again. Welcome back, Phil. How are you doing?
Oh, thanks for having me back, Russ. Yes, I'm doing well. Thank you. Good to talk to you again about the FA Cup. I know it's where you start to get involved in the competition with Brighton coming in at the third round. For me and the competition itself has obviously been going on for quite some time already this season, starting way back at the beginning of August.
Yes, exactly. Yes, I mean, we've only just got into it this weekend, just gone. But of course, it's been going since August, hasn't it? Absolutely ridiculously long competition. Did you say it was 700 matches that have been played so far?
Around that match, yeah. It's hard to know exactly with all the replays and stuff. But yes, with 732 teams entered in the competition, many of which have now obviously departed. I think by the end of this third round, we'll have lost 700 of them in total. So,
wow.
Imagine how many games we've had to take place to enable that to happen.
Yeah, well, that is madness. And we'll get on to talking about some of your highlights, key points or interesting bits of trivia or anything you want to throw away in a moment. But before we do, I've got to get on to my first burning question. Where are we at the moment in the Kettering versus Spurs high scoring stakes? Kettering are out of the competition, of course, but have they got back ahead going into Spurs' participation section of the tournament?
Funny enough, both clubs seem reluctant to be scoring too many goals this year to keep their challenge going. Kettering played four games in total, winning three of them 1-0, which... each of those goals enabled them to go two goals ahead of Tottenham at the top of the table in terms of the overall scoring charts. And Tottenham themselves have played one game, which they won 1-0. So right now, as it stands, Kettering Town are the current top scorers in the FA Cup history. Obviously, Tottenham have a chance against Man City. But if you wanted to try and break a record, going up against the cup holders and the winners of every trophy going last season, it's going to be quite difficult to get that top scoring record back again.
Yeah, I was just going to say that's might just hold on to it going into next year. That'll be an advantage gained despite their low scoring Kettering. Yeah, good luck to them. I want them to be ahead of Spurs, I've got to say. It's the old underdog sensibilities in me. I can't help it.
Yeah, I think many people are in your shoes as well. They're all looking to see that the lower level clubs do well in the FA Cup, whatever measure that you're looking at.
Yeah. And in terms of this year's competition, obviously it's been going on for a long while. What have been the key things that have stood out for you so far? I mean, for me, my hometown team, Worthing, got into the first round for the first time since, I think, something like 30 years. I can't remember the stat now. And then lost, unfortunately, 1-0 to a equivalent standard team from the National North, Alfreton, 1-0, which is a shame in pretty treacherous conditions. I think it was pretty rainy and sodden. Not a miserable day for Worthing and an unusually low scoring game actually for them. They keep scoring and conceding loads. So I was pleased for them on a personal level. But what about for yourself? Because you've been going around seeing loads of games and obviously overseeing the entire thing. And there must have been some good stories in there.
Well, there's always good stories, and it's very hard to remember them all. Yeovil Town have extended their record of the amount of times that they've made the Poppy Rounds as a non-league club. I think it's in the early 50s now, 52. I can't remember exactly the number. But it's pretty impressive stuff in terms of qualifying for the Poppy Rounds of the competition. We've also had Chesterfield. They got to the third round for the third successive season. And that's only the fifth time that's ever happened. Although it did happen last year with Bournemouth Wood. So, you know, maybe there's a sign that non-league clubs are getting better at this in the competition. And quite interesting, actually, with Maidstone United making the fourth round this year. Fantastic achievement for them. They've already played six ties to get to the fourth round. And that's as many as the winners will probably have to play. So, you know, they've already played more games than the winners will in the end. But that means that we have non-league representation in the fourth round for the fourth successive season, which hasn't happened since Blythe Spartans managed a fantastic run by back in 1978. So it's quite a good year for the non-league clubs in this season's competition.
Yeah, that's absolutely fantastic. I mean, it got top billing on the highlights in the Maidstone game when they won 1-0, which was great, against Stevenage, a decent side. And Steve Evans is no fool either, you know, the manager of them. So that was a good result for them. I'm pleased they got through because that's one of the grounds I've not been to. So I was hoping to get all them in the next round with the Albion, having got through as well. Another one being Eastleigh, but they're in the draw, but they haven't settled matters yet. They got a really good draw, though, didn't they?
They have. I mean, what an incentive for that match, Newport versus Eastleigh, the winners host Manchester United. So there's a massive, it's bound to be on TV, massive payday, great opportunity to pit yourself against some of the better players in the country. You never know. Pull off a shock of the century, who knows? But it's what the FA Cup's all about for me, is when you get those big mismatches between the top flight and lower level clubs. And we haven't had that. We haven't had any yet this season. The way the draw's gone so far, the non-league clubs have avoided top flight clubs. So that, if it is Eastleigh, that would be the first time this season that we see that kind of disparity.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of non-league teams, we've had quite a few incredible scorelines, not least the one you already know what I'm going to say next, the Swindon Aldershot game from round one. Yes. Swindon Town 4, Aldershot Town 7, which itself is an insane scoreline for any football match, not least for the fact that the non-league team was the away side.
Indeed. And,
that's the first time, isn't it? I think the stat is the first time a non-league team has ever scored 7 against a league team. Is that home or away, or just away?
Just away from home. So it's the first time that it's happened. Way back in 1905-06, Crystal Palace met Chelsea. When both were in the FA Cup for the first time, there's a lot of history between the two. Chelsea had become a Football League side whilst Crystal Palace had to settle for the Southern League. They met in the Cup, and back in the day, in the qualifying rounds, the Cup matches clashed with league games for Chelsea because it wasn't set up for league and Cup games. So Chelsea played reserves and Palace won 7-1. 7-1 being the current highest score of a non-league side over a league club. So when Aldershot went 7-0 up at Swindon, I was getting ready to type on the keyboard about how fantastic this is, what history it is, and what a brilliant result. And obviously it ended up 7-4, which in itself was a fantastic result. And as you said, they did set a new competition record by being the first non-league club to score 7 away from home at a Football League side in the FA Cup.
Yeah, it was incredible. I mean, the comeback itself, if it wasn't for the nature of it, it would have been, you would have thought, oh, that's an incredible comeback coming on there, but it didn't happen in the end. But yeah, what a scoreline. And looking at the results from that round, there were loads of high-scoring games, actually. There's a 5-1, a 4-0, a 7-2 Bristol Rovers winning against non-league opposition. There's a 5-1 for Eastleigh, actually, against Boreham Wood, which is a pretty decent result. And I think Harrogate won 5-1 at Marine. You had plenty of 3-2s and 2-2s and all that sort of thing. Where does it sit in terms of the numbers of goals scored for this stage of competition? Are we getting close to a record? It feels like we might be, but you'll know better than me. I don't know if you've got those stats to hand there, Phil.
I don't have them to hand, but from past research suggests that this isn't the golden period for goals being scored.
Oh, okay.
In competition back in the 20s, 30s, and maybe even in the 50s when the offside rule changed. I think there was a massive increase in goals scored. I haven't done the stats, but I get a sense that we have had periods in the past when there's been more goals scored per game. I think in the third round so far, there's 99 goals been scored in the 32 games, which is about 3 goals per game. It's not a bad average, but I think we've seen better than that in the past.
Lots of good goals as well being scored, especially in the last round. In fact, your boys, Leeds United, I knew there was going to be some goals in that, but I thought that was going to be something crazy like a 4-4 or a 4-3 win for your lot. But you actually ran out 3-0 winners. But I'm pretty sure that was the game, if I'm not mistaken, where Bamford cracked in an absolute worldie. Brilliant goal.
And I think the Puskas Award for Goal of the Year? I don't know what. It's up there. It's a fantastic intuitive strike, you've got to say. You know, on another day, you could have tried it and it would have gone anywhere. But when you watch it, it's just perfection and superbly done. And for Leeds, it's amazing. They don't have a great FA Cup record in recent times. Quite challenging for me supporting them as a big fan of the FA Cup to see my team not perform too well. Yeah. But we did. The club set a record in the competition in the third round.
This is for away draws, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So they were drawn away from home for the 13th successive time, which is just the odds on that is phenomenal. To and 2^13, whatever that number is, it's amazing. We've now finally got a home draw in the fourth round. So I did a massive cheer when that was pulled out of the hat yesterday, much as if we won the competition itself.
I mean, Leeds go in massive numbers. A conspiracy theorist might even think, hang on, what's going on here? Are they picking a big team to be the away team to get a bumper crowd for a home side? You could write all sorts of conspiracy theories into it, couldn't you? I was going to mention that stat, actually, but you've clocked it. And Aston Villa as well, I think, they'd had a bad record in the Cup in terms of elimination, hadn't they, in third round stage until this season's narrow win against Middlesbrough.
Yeah, if they'd have lost against Middlesbrough, it would have been, I think, their ninth successive defeat on the trot in the competition, which I think would have been a competition record for a team from the top flight to lose that many games successively in the competition. Wow. So things have turned around for them. They've won into the fourth round for the first time in 8 years. I'm sure. You know, there's a little bit of relief. I know a lot of people don't care for some of these side stats, but there's others who it hangs over them and they just want to get it off their backs and forget about it. And they can't do that for a while.
Well, we all like the good goals. And obviously, we mentioned the Bamford goal, but there's also, I think Kov scored a brilliant goal. Beautiful, took it, turn and shot from range. I think I was in the cup match, unless I'm mixing it up with the league game, I'm not sure. But there was also... who else? Forrest. I think it was Gibbs White. Someone had a brilliant drilled shot in the top corner. There's plenty more besides. I'll be doing a disservice.
I think the Tottenham winner was pretty impressive, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yes. That's right. Yeah. That was a cracker. Poro, wasn't it, that scored that? Yes. Yeah. So really good goals going in. What's good about it? I know we've listed some from bigger clubs there, but you tend to get some absolutely fantastic goals scored by anyone and in the leagues, up and down the land and in the cup. You know, some of the best goals I've ever seen have been scored either on a Sunday football field or in a non-league match or something like that. So they could come from anywhere, and that's one of the beauties of football, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
We scored some good ones as well, particularly Estupiñán's second goal in two games, actually. He just drilled one in again for us, which set us on the way in our match. We came through 4-2 in the end. Phil, what's the situation with Brighton in terms of our stats and how we line up at the moment? We've got another away draw away at Sheffield United. I'm not sure if we played them before in the competition.
Yeah, you have. Yeah, you've met twice before. You met way back in 1921-22 season when Brighton were in the third division south and Sheffield United were top flight at the time. And I think Brighton won 1-0. So one of the early shocks for the club. And you met again in more recent times. I think in the 1980s or 90s, 1986, 87, I think this time, I think Sheffield United did win that game when you were both in the second tier. So you have met before, you've got an even record. Game that could definitely go either way on the day itself, I think.
Yeah, I'm trying to think actually if that game, that second match you mentioned, was televised, because I remember watching a match when they still had the older format of the ground with the red pillars all the way along. I don't know if you remember that at Bramall Lane. I saw a game on TV. I think it was that match actually where they ran out. I think, was it 2-0 win or something like that, or 3-0?
I think they won it on a replay, so I'm not 100% sure.
Okay, yeah, might be mixing up the games, but so we'll go in hopeful, of course, because we feel we could beat any team on our day, with the possible exception of Man City. So glad to avoid them, that's for sure. not an exciting draw for any of us, obviously, but nonetheless, it's a winnable game, and as I said, we've still got Eastleigh, Maidstone and Wrexham are the only new grounds, potentially, for me in this competition.
Oh, right. Okay.
So, I'm really hoping we get Wrexham at some point because that's hard to go to there as a neutral because you can't get tickets. But I could if I was in the away end, obviously. I'm in top priority for that. That would be quite a tough fixture, but I wouldn't mind going there in the cup. In terms of Wrexham and other teams, are there any other standouts in terms of people's achievements this year, particularly those that are still in the competition at the moment?
Well, there's obviously a lot of clubs. Well, the bigger clubs are always in this fourth round. You know, it seems like perpetually they make it. Man City, 12 years since they failed to do so. Man United and Spurs, it's 10 years since they failed to get this far. And you've got other clubs like Fulham, Leicester, Liverpool and Southampton, it's 5 years. And then yourselves, Brighton, four successive seasons of making it this far. So I don't know how that sits in Brighton's record, but it sounds like it's quite a good run for them. From the past.
Yeah, we've quite often done, disappointingly, the competition when we've entered at the third round stage, and also when we were in Leagues 1 and 2 and entering at the first round stage.
Yeah.
It was a long time. I think it was a long period where we didn't get anywhere near the third round, anywhere near the fourth round anyway.
And then you've got other clubs who we talked about earlier, Aston Villa, who have made it through for the first time in 8 years, and Watford, they had their first win since they were in the cup final back in 2019, so they've gone some time without winning a game. And then you have Newcastle as well, who haven't got the greatest recent record in the FA Cup, and it's the first time for 4 years they've made it this far, having beaten their local rivals Sunderland. They're obviously very happy up there in the northeast.
Yeah.
They came against Fulham in the fourth round. They've met four times in the past in the competition, and Newcastle won every time and scored 20 goals in total, a minimum of four goals every time they've met Fulham in the Cup. So if history is anything to go by, they should be going into that game quite full of confidence.
Yeah. Another one that stood out for me was the Bristol teams, both earned replays away to higher-ranked opposition from higher divisions.
Mm.
Bristol Rovers were at Norwich, and Bristol City got another good goal there to equalise at West Ham, which will draw a really big crowd for the replays, I'm sure, in both cases. Those are sort of underachieving teams from an underachieving city in football terms, aren't they, by and large? I think Bristol Rovers never seem to be quite as high as I think they should be in the league, let alone with runs in the cup. And Bristol City have obviously, they're way too big to have not really been then troubling the Premier League in any of its years since inauguration in 92. So I don't know if one of them goes on a big cup run. There could be a Bristol derby, I suppose, feasibly at some point.
Yes, they've got tough ties to get through still. Obviously got to beat higher league opposition in the replay. I think both teams would be a bit disappointed they didn't do the job in the first game, because I've seen what I saw on the TV that it suggests that both of them had their chances to win. The City versus West Ham game has been picked by the BBC to show live for the replay, so we'll get a chance to see how well they do. And fun enough, the teams that they will play, Forest or Blackpool, was the other game that the ITV have chosen to show live. So Bristol City do win that game. They've got a home tie, which might give them a chance. But Bristol Rovers' task looks a bit more tougher to get through to maybe have a derby against City, as even they've got to get ahead of Norwich, which I think is doable. But, on the day, who knows? And then they've got to travel to Liverpool if they manage to do that. And I think that'll be a bit more of a challenge in total.
Yep. And your guys have got Plymouth at home.
Yes.
Which is your first home game for your... Are you confident with that one, do you think, Phil?
No. I've learned not to be confident with Leeds United. I remember we had a good run a few years ago when we were in the Premier League and we got to the quarterfinals and we had second tier Wolves at home. And I thought, this is going to be our year. This is definitely our year. And we blew it. We lost 1-0 at home. It was horrendous. And so we just learned the hard way not to have hope in this competition.
It's too random, isn't it? Particularly with so many rounds still to play. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you tend to not win the ones you should and win the ones that you don't think you ought to. It's a bit bizarre sometimes like that.
Mm, yeah, that's it. That pretty much sums things up as they are for now. We'll love to get you back on at some point, maybe a later stage in the tournament this year. It's all to play for a lot of teams, big matches, some interesting matchups, and I'm sure that will carry on round to round. In terms of TV, the only other thing I was going to mention with TV, as always, it's frustrating, isn't it? I think the choices were predictable but irritating. I mean, for example, BBC with Arsenal against Liverpool, which Liverpool won 2-0. Those sort of games, because the BBC don't cover the Premier League live, getting an opportunity to have a live match coverage of those games, they're not going to pass it up. And it's about ratings and that sort of thing, isn't it? The commercial channels you can understand more because of the advertising, but do you find it a bit disappointing when the BBC pick that? I know you can see why they've done it, but there were so many more enticing ties, weren't there, in this this round that's just gone, or just going through?
Well, there's a couple of things there, really. Firstly, I don't think the size of the TV audience will be that different, regardless of what game they pick. It's a live game on terrestrial TV, which doesn't happen too often. And we know that there's an interest in watching live football on the TV. And so, yes, they pick Liverpool v Arsenal because they know that has a more worldwide appeal. But in the UK, it doesn't matter if they'd have shown that game or if they'd have shown the Maidstone game. I think the TV audience would have been, you know, around about 500,000 difference, that's all. So, you know, not too much. ITV, yes, they will always go for the big clubs. And I made a statement a few weeks ago when the TV choices were made, that saying that the TV channels aren't showcasing the FA Cup. So they're not using their channels to showcase the FA Cup. They're using the FA Cup to showcase their channels, which is why they choose all Premier League games rather than choosing the games that epitomise what the FA Cup's about in terms of non-league. So it's quite interesting when Maidstone won, they were all over the story. You know, isn't this fantastic? It's the epitome of the FA Cup. It's what the competition's all about. Maidstone have won. Yeah, well, why didn't you show it? Why did you not pick it and give yourself a chance to be there when the glory happened?
Exactly. And to give those clubs a rare chance to really make some extra money. I mean, obviously, they'll make some round-to-round by progression, but yeah, the TV money could have been a huge difference to a club like that. Although they're well run, actually, Maidstone. Apparently, they, according to the highlights on the BBC, they make a profit year on year. So they've been excellently run. But nonetheless, they still deserve the reward. They shouldn't be penalised for that.
No, and I think also, you know, there's more likelihood that the Arsenal, Liverpool, Man United, they'll get through to the later round. So you have a chance to show them then. So give the third round, give the opportunity for those that have struggled through to get there and give them a moment in the sun. But unfortunately, that's not the way the commercial element of these TV channel choices works.
Yeah, frustrating. Maybe something for the regulators to try and have a pull. That's not going to happen, is it?
But that's not going to happen. I mean, I've complained to the BBC. I think I did it for 5 years on the trot when they kept picking all Premier League side games, and they've just got the same stock response. Yeah, we choose what we choose because we want to maximise our ratings or interest in the competition. But it's baloney.
None of that justifies Palace v Everton on a Thursday night, does it, though?
Well, I think that was a legacy of the fact that they had to move all these games, spread them across, because all the London clubs had been drawn at home, and it was the Met Police saying you can't have that many games at home at the same time. So, yeah, whilst it wasn't a great choice, and I said the comment that it was as exciting on grass as it appeared it might be on paper. it turned out this nil-nil draw, ball draw. It wasn't very exciting at all. I'm just glad they haven't chosen to show it again in the replay. Probably end up being a 5-5 cracker, but, you know, that's the way it goes.
Indeed. Well, Phil, it's been great having you back on. For anyone that doesn't know, you're regularly popping up talking about the FA Cup and the FA Trophy and FA Vase on the non-league podcast, aren't you, which you're semi-regular on there. For anyone that doesn't listen to that and therefore doesn't know, I'll ask you to do what the presenters on there do as well, and just throw out there your Twitter or X and other contacts.
Still Twitter, always, I think always will be.
Twitter, yeah, let's stick with that, yeah.
Yeah, so you can find me on Twitter covering all the competition, primarily the FA Cup and FA Vase. I am in the midst of working out I can do the FA Trophy as well. FA at FA Cup Fact File and at FA Vase Fact File is the place where I produce all the stats, and there's links there to all my previews and reviews of every single round that goes on during the season.
Fantastic. Cheers, Phil. Thanks for joining us. Until the next time, thanks. Cheers.
Oh, cheers, and good luck to Brighton in the next round.
Cheers. Oh, thanks very much. And dare I say it to Leeds, I'll be unpopular.
You can cut that bit out.
Cheers.
Cheers, mate. Bye-bye.
So thanks there to Phil Annette for joining us in part one, talking about the FA Cup. And we're going to talk about it a bit more now, because it's time for me to welcome my pod squad members. And it's the two Andys, or two of the Andys. It's Andy Bass and Andy Knott. Hello, Andys. How are you both?
Yeah, good. Thank you very much.
Me too. Happy New Year.
Yes. First time I've seen you guys since the new year began.
Exactly, yeah, and it's been a while since we've done one of these the Zoom reviews, and it's been good recently. I think a creditable draw away at West Ham, and then of course at the weekend the 4-2 win against Stoke. And we'll talk on a few other matters as well later on, but let's get on to the game first of all. Now, Andy Bash, you were at the match, so was I. Andy Kay, you weren't, but I'm sure you've seen the highlights and so on as well. So, in terms of the match, 4-2, chatting off air with you, Andy B, beforehand, we were saying, I think I felt the same as you in that you said you always felt comfortable with this result overall. It didn't feel as if we were going to screw it up. And even though it was a bit topsy-turvy, we conceded a goal, came from behind, then conceded an equaliser, but eventually got the better of them to get those last two goals. It was a good game, quite entertaining, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was very bizarre. It was actually the first non-league game featured on Match of the Day. So we actually topped the billing for the, above the contractually obligated, let's show the ultra minnows thing. And yeah, it was an entertaining game. It was pretty end to end. Certainly in the first half, I didn't think we played that well in the first half, but it was thoroughly entertaining. And I never, even when we went behind, I never thought we weren't going to win. I just thought we're going to win this, and it was really a different feeling to our other visits to the Bet365, particularly obviously thinking back to the I think what was it 2011, 2012 game
Yeah,
where
twenty
we
twelve.
where we were very much like the League One underdogs to the Premiership.
Yes.
Stoke. And how the tables have turned. I mean, it was just interesting, and it was reassuring. I just think we took care of business in the end. Gave away the sloppy opener, but other than that, I thought we were really good.
Yeah. Own goal scored by Van Hecke. We've got a new nickname for him. We'll be discussing that later on, coming up a little bit later. Andy Kay smiling. It's his. He's brought that to the table. But anyway, yeah. The goal, by the way, Estupiñán scoring again. I mean, the bonus of him coming on for the whole of the second half in the last match. Oh, sorry, the game. Sorry, against Spurs, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And scoring a worldie, and then he scored a pretty good goal here, didn't he? And which. Was a key one in the match. Van Hecke had conceded the own goal in the 16th minute. This was the equaliser. 6 minutes into first half stoppage time, and a cracking strike, wasn't it? And I think, wow, not only is he back doing what he does, he's doing that as well now. That's not too bad, is it, Andy Kay? Pretty pleased with that.
Yeah, one thing that you haven't mentioned that I think you're alluding to is goal just before half time. Always a fine time to score a goal, and we got one. What was it? 8 minutes into the second half, I think it was.
Yeah, seven or eight minutes in. Donkey, of
Yeah,
course.
yeah. And another assist for Gross, and then he had another assist, and then a pre-assist as well. So.
And he's on the highlights. They were picking up on his pedigree in that regard, weren't they?
On what match of the day? Yeah,
Yeah.
but yeah. I mean, I actually watched it on with some Irish commentary live, or a minute or two behind things. So I've got a pretty good picture of the game, and I'd agree with that broad assessment from Andy, despite the fact that we went behind in the first half and spent, what was it, 25, 30 minutes. Being one goal down, despite the fact that they equalised pretty soon after our goal, I wasn't too concerned about not winning. But obviously, I was saying, even when it went to all, and you would have been saying, I would imagine, that I'd rather lose this than draw it. Because I really think that these 16 days, I think the squad has gone out to Dubai, haven't they, to get some warm weather, get out of this freezing temperature over here. And we really, really do need that for the second half of the season. I've got a quick question to ask you two, actually, because you were mentioning about 2011, 2012 in Stoke, I gather that there really weren't too many people in the stadium or Stoke fans in the stadium. And it's a kind of salutary lesson about what happens to clubs when they get relegated from the Premier League and don't look as though they're in a position to be promoted again.
Yeah, I thought.
Sorry. Yeah, it's kind of like, was there a bad vibe amongst the home fans or whatever?
No, I don't think there was a bad vibe from the home fans that turned up. They, they were quiet, but when they scored and were in the league, they got behind their team. And I don't think you can have a go at the Stoke fans that turned up. It's the ones that didn't. It's a disappointment for them. And it's a bit sad, really. The first time we went there, the ground was full. And it was a really good atmosphere. And when they were like duking it out in the Premier League, it was the archetypal difficult place to go for any away team. And I think that lack of atmosphere helped us. Also, the fact that we had, a rather ridiculous number of fans that actually did go to that. I think they're all trying to get their 15 points for the away leg over the next round of the Europa League. But that notwithstanding, we were backed well. I thought our support was excellent. Their fans were good for a bit, but they were quiet in other things. But it is surreal, and it just feels wrong playing a game in where they've closed one entire side of the ground. Obviously, it's more expense, and so it's cold, it's expensive, still up there. So I'm not really going to cast aspersions on anyone who decided they had better things to do with their money or time on Saturday afternoon.
But it was kids for a quid and 15 quid, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think I've actually watched some a Stoke vlog. Of the game. It's quite interesting to see it from their perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And they seem to be very supportive. I don't know. I think their fans are quite hopeful for the future with their new manager. But it was just weird. But I just thought that we really turned up for work in this one. Frustrating first half. In terms of sort of like final ball quality was not very good, but the intent was there. I don't think we were ever taking it easy. I do suspect that Roberto might have had a few words of encouragement, shall we say, at half time to maybe spur on the effort somewhat. And it clearly had an effect because, we came out all guns blazing second half, and even like their penalty just didn't keep us down. And I like the way that the players celebrated the goals. They really cared. They wanted to do it. I think they think we can win it.
I think so.
And I think our fans think we've got a chance, especially the way the draw's panning out. And, if worse comes to the worst, even if we got one of the so-called big guns, like, City or Liverpool or something, I mean, these are teams that we no longer cow before we play them.
Yeah, but of all teams, I would rather avoid City and Liverpool. And if they knock each other out and maybe Tottenham Tottenham are drawn against City, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. Chelsea got Villa. Not that we can really call Chelsea a big club anymore. But hey. But no, I mean, it'll be good to get rid of those teams. And yeah, I mean, obviously City and Liverpool can't knock each other out. One can knock the other out. But if one of them's out and then maybe Arsenal beats Liverpool, someone could take the Arsenal
are out.
Oh, they're Arsenal out. Of course they are. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, this is the thing. We've had that big match already. We've got two more big matches. I think we can do Sheffield United. I'm not expecting it. Take it for granted. But it's an okay draw. It could be a lot worse. But going back to what you were saying, Andy, and answer to Andy Kay's question, question. Yeah, I'd go along with what Andy said about the fans. I don't think there was any toxicity of any sort there. I think everyone seems quite happy, but there just weren't that many people there. It's interesting the way they've arranged the crowd to be in as optimum a possible position for the TV cameras. It was very patently obvious when you're at the game and you can see they've sold from the far left-hand corner as you look from the camera along towards the goal and just beyond it, and then there was no one else. Stand to our left where the TV camera is placed had absolutely no one in there apart from one small section, squared section of fans.
Family
and friends and all that stuff, yeah. And then I think they intended to do was to sell the other big stand opposite the cameras all the way around to at least the corner, which they were unable to achieve. But I think it is a salutary lesson about where you can be from now versus elsewhere. A lot of Albion fans would say, we could do with a bigger ground. Not that it's realistic that we'll get one, but 35 or 40, you know, would be better because you can sell more on, say, for example, you get someone like Newcastle, you can give them their 5,000 or 6,000 and we can still sell out the rest and that kind of thing. And all the time we're doing well, yes, we could. But I think, as you've said there, Andy Kay, if or when, whichever it is, that we end up back in the Championship or worse, it is quite sad when you see someone like Stoke and it's such a big stadium for the amount of people that were there. There certainly were not 17,000, as apparently has been claimed.
No way.
I think that we're talking 13 tops for that game. We had 4,000 sell out, didn't we, or 3,950 or whatever it was. And they didn't have more than twice that. So I'd say 13,000 maximum for that game. But, you know, it's the state of play. You know, they're in that position at the moment. They'll probably come good at some point later on. There will be occasions where they'll fill that ground, even if they don't, you know, for a big cup match. If they've got to a quarter final as a Championship team, they'd get loads in. But it is a bit, yeah, it feels a bit soulless and a little bit sad seeing that many empty seats at a ground. It's not ideal, but from our side of it, the away fans, getting 4,000 fans to that game shows you what the interests are from away supporters.
It's incredible. I mean, it might be partly down to the cost of the ticket, and as Andy has said about the 15 points for the Europa League.
Those two things make the difference.
The distance, which is what put me off going.
It's a long way.
You know, to get 4,000 there, that's really something for an FA Cup third round tie. It's great.
There is something about the cup, though. It's like you kind of, whilst you're still in it, the magic is still there, and there is that possibility. I do think, we're fighting on loads of fronts. It was disappointing to get knocked out of the League Cup, but you know, still like Europa League. Amazingly, we are seventh, is it, in the league, despite the fact we've only got two players. And now, like the FA Cup, I think it's unfinished business for us. And I just think that's the mentality that particularly De Zerbi has brought to this football club. And I think he's kind of like dragging Bloom and Barbara along a little bit. But I mean, they are full of enthusiasm for it as well. They see the opportunities. But I think they've now finally got a manager that matches their vision. And De Zerbi, he wants to win something. He doesn't care what it is.
Yeah. And he's pumped, isn't he?
But he wants something to put on his mantelpiece at the end of the season.
Absolutely. He was pumped. He wanted it. He wanted to win big time.
Yeah, and do you know what? I mean, that was a frustrating defeat in the semi-final last season because, I think we're better than Manchester United at the moment.
We were certainly better than them on the day, I think, as well. I mean, there wasn't a great deal on it, but I think we were better. I'm going to move the conversation on to some of the players in the game and the goals, if that's all right with you.
Yeah. Well, I'll just read out, I'll read out the team then. So Verbruggen was in goal. We thought it was going to be quite a youth-laden team, didn't we, due to various circumstances with our squad. But it was Verbruggen in goal. It was Van Hecker, Dunk and Stupinan at the back, with Hinchelwood, Modder going wider of Grosch and Gilmore, Buonanotte, Ferguson and Joao further forward. So that was the starting 11. And Belaba, Hinchy, not Hinchelwood, but Hinchy, Webster, Welbeck, Perpignan, who's been recalled from a loan, and Lallana were the subs that were used at various points. So, yeah, over to you, Andy Kay.
Yeah, well, I've already mentioned Pascal, 2 assists and a pre-assist. If others have listened to me rambling on the match day special, you and I, which one was that at? Was that at
West Ham, wasn't it?
West Ham, was it? Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, there's no competition. Despite the brilliance of certain other players, about who our player of the season is, and that's Pascal. He's just been utterly immense, and Roberto loves him. You know, he virtually has no time off. Yet he's still leading the press in the 94th minute, you know, chasing down the goalkeeper. You know, and I'm one of these dreadful people that did wonder about his future, in the kind of early middle of the Potter years, where he wasn't that good.
We're both saying yes as well.
Yeah, me too, sadly.
I didn't think he was that good. And I really didn't like the way that Gross and Moy featured in the same team,
yeah,
who were too similar. But wow, the guy is utterly amazing. Gilmore, I also want to mention in terms of the form that he's been in over the last 2 or 3 months, and particularly the way in which he's stepped forward with the injury crisis that we've had. I mean, he's really come on this season. Obviously, we didn't really see João Pedro last season, but there's 2 goals here. I might go and speak about the 2 goals, but I also want to speak about Van Hecker and the way in which he's come on as well. And he was really, really good. But in terms of the goals, my view of the 3 of them, and I'm talking about the second half goals here, we actually got a goal from a corner. It was a short corner, and we did get another one as well. João Pedro got one. Who was that against? A flipped header against Chelsea, maybe?
Yes,
somebody lost.
Yeah, Chelsea.
Yeah.
And pretty much the same header he got on Saturday, actually.
No, it wasn't. The one against Chelsea was really close by, a kind of flick inside the 6-yard box. Whereas I thought his header for the 3rd goal was really similar to the one that he got against Forest, actually.
Ah, yeah. Yeah, that's a spot box though.
But yeah, the second one, short corner, and then Gross worked his magic, back post, Dunk put it in. The 3rd one, lots of good interplay down the right. Gross and Hinchelwood seem to be kind of reinvoking the Gross Solly relationship down the right wing, which has been utterly amazing at times.
Yeah.
And he put in another great cross. And there was that header from João Pedro, which was, you know, another great header that went into the corner effectively. Mm-hmm. Tough on the goalkeeper. And then the 4th goal, there was, well, somebody had a premonition of something that was about to happen. That happened, was announced yesterday, which was the death of Franz Beckenbauer. And Van Hecker became Van Heckenbauer for the 4th goal.
Noted, ladies and gentlemen.
I love that. he played, I think, a couple of 1-2s, the last of which was with Pascal, and just completely broke their defence. I thought the goal was actually really quite similar to Argentina's 1st goal in the World Cup final, in which Ali Mack was kind of key to that. I think it was Di Maria that scored in the end. I thought it was quite quite similar, but he strode, you know, through their high line, completely exposed it, and João Pedro kind of slided it in, and the celebration looked really, really good there. But perhaps over to you two on that particular point.
Yeah, well, I'll start first with that. Yeah, absolutely agree. And I was at an event yesterday, a Seagulls Over London thing, and Raymond was talking about that goal. And the way he was leading up to what he was going to say, I knew what he was going to say. He was going to reference Mark Lawrenson, because that roving centre-back driving on beyond his normal remit area, and he was bursting down that right side. And it was brilliant, wasn't it? It was great to see. As you said, Van Heckenbauer, that's brilliant. We've definitely got to keep using that one. But yeah, it was great. And the celebration, yeah, essentially what happened, because of the geography of the situation, Van Hecker was at the fans before João was, and João was kind of almost deference in the way he then approached him and kind of joined him with the celebration. And I thought that was great. You know, it really was the reward for his work in the build-up to that and the assist, which is superb. And having scored the own goal, of course, it's a redemption for him within the match as well, which is nice. And I go along with what was said earlier, that Pascal Grosch is player of the season, and the only person that's giving him a challenge at the moment is Van Hecker. I think he's Van Heckenbauer, sorry. I've got to get the name right. Because he's been absolutely superb. And the point I was going to make, actually, as well, about our squad over the course of the season, we'll get into a more generic discussion about the season and what we're thinking going forwards later. But this season, it's been interesting because there's been phases to the season where, obviously, we've signed João Pedro and he'd made an impact earlier in the season, but it was really about players like Evan Ferguson continuing his advancement early on, Adingra hitting the ground running after his loan last season, after we'd signed him, those players doing well earlier on. And then later in the season, Jack Hinchwood was breaking into the team and making an impact, surprisingly quickly, when Anote has found his feet as well now. Obviously being played in the correct position has helped more often than not. And then the continued improvement of João Pedro and various other players who've seemed to have improved more and more. Billy Gilmore being the other one, of course, another young player. All of those players we've listed, João included, are still young. And that's been a very big feature of this season, I think. And aside from all the bit parts with players unexpectedly getting sub appearances and all the rest of it, we mentioned a few of them in this match here, that's been a major triumph for us this season. And I think it's had to be because of the injuries we've had and the rotation involved and the number of games and the demands, but I think broadly speaking it's worked pretty well, hasn't it? And it's testament to how well Roberto De Zerbi can bring players on, not just the young players, but in particular how well he's done in that regard has been why we've been able to do as well as we have, which is to be in roughly the same position as we finished last season in the table, taking on board the additional huge challenge of a Europa campaign as well, and having far more injuries than last year. So it's been absolutely extraordinary. And I think it's testament to everyone at the club, but most particularly Roberto De Zerbi, how well we've brought those players through. And Jack Hinchwood is the epitome of that, isn't he, in terms of the youth players?
Absolutely. I mean, this is all on De Zerbi and the way that he pushes every member of the squad. It's not just the first choice 11 that we've heard of. He pushes everybody in that squad. We've spoken about it before earlier in the season, with maybe slight frustration with some of the rotation, but now you can see it paying off because these players aren't new players anymore. I mean, there's been some established players that have been out for a while are now going to find that, oh, these new guys are now playing really well in their position. How do you get back in the team? You know, it's like, I mean, it just now we are tooling up for possibly what could be the most momentous, three or four months in this club's history. And De Zerbi's made sure has now given us enough artillery to sort of like really have a go at it, really give it a good go. I mean, who knows how it's going to end up? We don't know whether it's going to be successful, whether it fizzles out. But we've given ourselves an opportunity now to genuinely dream of bigger things than we would have dreamt of before. And I think that dream is being relayed to the players, because I think the players feel that, yeah, you know what, we can achieve these things. These aren't pipe dreams anymore. These are achievable goals, and everybody can play a part. It's not just like, you know, what was notionally like the first 11 or the first 15, but now there's like 25 players involved. It doesn't matter whether you're a youth, you know, whether you came from the youth team like Hinshelwood, or if you're an established veteran like Pascal Gross. The contributions have come from everywhere, and people like Buonanotte have really had to step up. You know, with Enciso, we've lost key players. We lost key players just when they were maturing. Like Enciso was finally becoming a potential superstar player, and then
we signed Fatty, and he comes into it, yeah. He gets injured.
Yeah,
Fatty, who is definitely a potential superstar, and he gets injured. Solly March, playing the best football of his career, suddenly has it his entire year taken
Eagle
away
as well.
And so all of these things, but people have come in. Hinshelwood's come in, Buonanotte's come in, Moda's coming back now. I mean, you can see he's not up to speed yet, but Deserby's giving him the chance to get up to speed, and he's only going to do it with those minutes on the pitch. I thought, you know, he's on his way to recovery now. He's on his way. And obviously we're in the January transfer window, which we'll probably have a quick chat about later. But there's certainly at least one very exciting addition coming in. And we're going to think, well, where can we play him? But we need all of these players. The Premier League is so hard. It's much harder to finish sixth this year than it was last year, I think. Much harder. So if we're aiming for that, we need more people to step up to the pump. And deserve it. I've thought for like the last sort of month and a half, I just thought, this team's going to be really good in March and April. It's going to be really good in March and April. When people are back, when people have had their time, and we've got through like this lean period of like, you know, quite a lot of draws. We haven't lost many games.
Mm.
So even though we've gone through a dry spell, we've still been accruing additional points. But we are now building up that war chest to really go for it in the crucial part of the season. I'm so excited. It's incredible.
Oh, so am I. And yeah, I've listed all the things we've done and where we are in the table and how well the season's gone overall, despite the adversity. And we have now, as I think Andy Cove mentioned, reached that position where we can relax a little bit. We've got to a stage now where we've got a very welcome paucity of fixtures over the next few weeks, especially avoiding a replay in that cup match. It's going to be a lot easier to cope, I think, now. And we need to make our mark in the next couple of months before it gets more intense. But I think we've reached the stage of the season that we knew was coming, but with a satisfying amount of points. I mean, we could have had more. We should have had more, actually. I think we should have grabbed points in games despite tactics. To the contrary, we should have still overwhelmed those in certain matches, particularly the Sheffield United game.
Those three 1-1 draws that Roberto keeps on referring to.
So it could be even better. But one thing, just going back to what I was saying about the younger elements in the team as well, one stat that's been thrown around a lot as well is about how many goals we've scored from teenagers. Jack Hinshelwood's goal against Spurs, great goal, by the way, fantastic, wasn't it, with Joao's build-up play, was our 19th Premier League goal scored by a teenager in 2023, which I think Andy Kayu actually popped on one of the WhatsApp groups at one point. The next nearest is Man United in second place with 4. And apparently the whole of the Premier League has only collectively had 16 goals scored by teenagers outside of the Albion. So, yeah, we've got more than the rest of the Premier League put together, which shows how much of a value there is on those players. Yes, obviously, Evan Ferguson being a key part of that. But even then, he's kind of gone a little bit off the radar a bit, and he's not in the best of form. I don't think he's lost his confidence or anything, but he's just not quite finding the chances that he would like. He still looks sharp when he tries to take them, like the West Ham game. You know, it's a really classy, quick bit of instinctive play to work the space to try and have a shot. It didn't quite work, but I don't feel as if he's losing confidence. I think you just go in and out of form in general, don't you? And I think, but you know, his goals have helped. But those stats are incredible.
Yeah, they are. I mean, in terms of Ferguson, if you listen to Roberto's press conferences, he tends to be a lot more revealing than our prior managers and many other managers. And he has explicitly said that Evan's been carrying a little bit of an injury. Because of the injury situation, he's been hugely overused. So I don't think it's necessarily the fairest way to judge him. But I think you are right in saying that he hasn't really got into the kind of opportunities that he capitalizes on, because his goal scoring is amazing. And let's hope that with the injuries coming back and the emergence of a couple of players, I think really the ones that have kind of surprised us over the last couple of months are Buonanotte and Hinchelwood. I mean, yeah. Hinchelwood is just so mature for an 18-year-old and looks so exciting, really does. And Buonanotte really seems to kind of bolt up. He seems to be enjoying playing centrally far more. He's really filled in extremely well. Can go on the odd kind of mazy run. There's that earlier, I think, kind of unhelpful linkage with Messi that was kind of made with him. Tevez certainly mentioned that connection with Messi, which I thought was a little bit harsh, but I'm going to do something similarly harsh. Where that he reminds me of a little bit is Bernardo Silva, which is a delightful prospect. As far as I'm concerned,
That's not a bad comparison. If he turns out to be half as good as Bernardo Silva, I think we'll all be very happy.
Yeah.
Because he's a terrific player.
And the thing about Hinchelwood is, I mean, I take Andy's point about the rotation. And I think I can't remember the stats actually, but at a certain point, De Zerbi had used kind of twice as many players as the next, or made twice as many changes as the next that has done. But, you know, largely over the last 2 or 3 months, it's been because of the injury situation. It hasn't been through choice. And, you know, I'll wait to be convinced by the point that Andy made about the rotation bearing fruits in kind of March, April, etc., etc. My thoughts, well, let me just say two things about the second half of the season. One is what I was trying to say about Hinchelwood is, when everyone gets back fit, how much is he going to play? I suspect a fair bit, actually, but who's going to have to give way for him to play a fair bit? And that's a kind of mouth-watering prospect. You know, because of him, all of a sudden, I'm less concerned about our fullback situation, which I was, you know, really quite concerned with a month or two ago. You know, it went on to attacking wide players, and it's still there, but De Zerbi in his brilliance has found a way around that. And the kind of performances that we've put in really in the last three games, Tottenham especially, was, I think, you know, I don't think we've been that good this season, for what it's worth, compared to the second half of last season. We were very good at the start of the season against the likes of Man United, Wolves. But that Tottenham display might have been our best of the season, actually. I thought that was just a thrilling game of football. I mean, Ange played into our hands completely.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I think the thrilling nature of the football this season has struggled to live up to that we had last year. But then the reasons for that are obvious because we have been decimated with injuries. And to be honest, that was one of the reasons I kind of quite liked the West Ham game a little bit, even though it was for the neutral, it was not exciting. It was barely a game of interest for the two interested parties. But actually, we particularly in the first half, like, you know, West Ham were like sitting back. And this was like the first time I really saw like a return to like the original model of like De Zerbi ball, where we started passing it around the back and then really trying to tease out that central pass that's going to take out one or two players. And because of the sort of the chopped up nature of this season for us, we've kind of like freelanced a bit more, or it seems to me that we freelanced a little bit more and haven't been as disciplined in that pure De Zerbi ball. And actually against West Ham, we played some quite nice De Zerbi ball, and against like a very well-drilled Moyes, you know, back 11, we were able to tease out a small number of opportunities from which we probably should have done a bit better and won the game. But I thought we did well to create those opportunities in the first place, because there wasn't a lot of space for us to do it. And I thought, you know, we got back to the intricate passing and stuff. So I think we're not playing one style of football anymore. I think we've got a plan A, but I think we've got a plan B and C and possibly a D as well now. I think we're much more flexible in how we adapt to like the in-game situations. Again, this is all down, you know, De Zerbi's coaching and the way that the players have responded to it. It really is some excellent work, and it's all happening before our eyes on the pitch. I mean, there's so much learning on the job here with such a difficult style of play, the demands that are being put on those players. And the way they respond is brilliant. There really is just this. If you're a time waster, you are going nowhere in this team, because get out. Well, we need people that are going to put a shift in, put the work in, and I just think there is that togetherness in the squad.
Yeah, I mean, if I can add something to that, I find that really interest in what you're saying, because what I originally thought about De Zerbi ball was that he was quite rigid in his formation, because all the players needed to be so drilled, not only in passing sequences, but knowing where the other player is. And you need that rigidity or formation in order to do that. But he seems to have kind of worked kind of hybrid formations into the system, where we kind of shift between a back four in possession, or is it a back? No, it's a back four when defending, and then a back three in possession. And it kind of started off when Belieber kind of dropped back into the kind of sweeper role. But he's kind of amended it a little bit, where you're kind of playing Purvis Purvis or Eagle, Duncan and Van Hecker as a kind of three, and then the likes of Hinchinwood, Gross, Milner or Moda playing as, you know, really wide players in the absence of Solly, Fatty, Inciso, Adingra, Mittema being out, which has kind of been dreadful, when the way in which kind of Bonanotte's slipped into that role. So there is that kind of variety in there. I suppose a question that I've still got for him is, and in terms of the West Ham game, actually, against a side that's very good, very well organised at playing that block, and in terms of the West Ham game, I thought the first half was really very dull indeed, actually. And that was down to them, and we weren't terribly good, but we still created that, that gross chance.
Yeah,
which was really disappointing. That
that was a bad miss, I think. He'd won that one again, because the ball from Milner was terrific, but I don't think he knew where Areola was. So I think might have just been like an instinct that I've got to flick it into the corner, where actually all he needed to do was just head it straight ahead, because Areola was right next to him, and he would have had a much better chance of scoring going that way. But it took a lot of work to get that opportunity to score.
Yeah, it did. And in the second half, I thought we were actually all over them. Oh, and
fantastic.
In terms of a Moyes West Ham side, that bodes well for those teams that come and play the kind of deep block against us, I would say. Bodes very well the way in which we did kind of begin to cut through them. And I will note that I think our expected goals in that game was 2.5 or something like that. Mm. So it was really about the finishing not being quite hasn't really been a feature of De Zerbi ball, actually. You know, it was a feature of possible, wasn't it?
I almost wonder if in that game, because we were basically the wingless wonders going back to the 1950s, or was that the 60s? Was that Ramsey? It was Alf Ramsey, wasn't it? Wingless.
Yeah, 60s.
But it kind of forced us to play through the middle against West Ham. And then I think when Lallana came on, and he's one of the best close control players I think I've ever seen. I mean, that guy can turn on a sixpence. In such a sport, he created his own chance in that game. But we were working our way through the middle, and you're right. It's like we've had trouble against the low block all season. De Zerbi's been trying to figure out how we can beat it, and I think now we're getting a few more ideas about how to do it. You know, in the way that we were unsuccessful before. Now we're thinking, well, we might be able to like break through on occasion, but when we do, we have to be more ruthless.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, isn't it? Everyone's talking about, oh, people will find Brighton out; they'll work a way out to negate their challenges, their threats. But yeah, that works the other way as well. We can work out how to negate their workings out on us. But yeah, it's a constantly evolving scenario, isn't it?
Yeah.
Football tactics, and that's what's one of the fascinating elements about it. I was going to say, actually, on João Pedro, by the way, I mean, he's starting to get a lot of vibes in the old transfer rumour mill already, isn't he? No particular connections, but people are saying, oh, are they going to be able to hold on to him? He scored 15 goals this season already now in 28 games. There was
it's only Salah and Haaland that have got more.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, his ratio of scoring, that's pretty impressive. And although for years people would casually quote the, oh, we need a 20-goal-a-season striker, and if you're a Premier League team, that's ridiculous. Hardly anyone has that. Yeah. Actually, we might have one, ironically, this season, because we're just under half the season left. In fact, probably slightly more than, depending on how well we do in the Cups. He's already got 15 goals. And there was a Watford fan on the comments after the Stoke match that said, as a Watford fan, so pleased João Pedro has found the right Premier club. So glad he's doing so well in his development and such an asset to Brighton. And I think he really is. And if we do sell him, he'll be a financial asset on as he's outbounds. But I think I'd like to think we'll hold on to him a bit longer than the end of this season. I hadn't even thought about losing him so soon. I don't think we will, but who knows?
I would be surprised if we get an offer that would tempt us, to be honest. But he's been brilliant. He's been absolutely outstanding. And I know that some people would say, well, he scored, but half his goals are penalties. But I'll tell you what, they all count. Take it from a team that never did continually miss penalties. Over the last few years and lost points due to it, they all count. Those are goals.
Yeah.
And you try scoring 100% of your penalties. It's exactly. not easy. And exactly. But his enthusiasm, he's had to adapt. It was quite interesting. I think Brian Owen had a chat with him. He's had a chat with him after a couple of games. And he was just saying, yeah, we've had to adapt because obviously the wide players are out. So obviously like me and Facundo can like, you know, we've played there before, so we will move out. Like the adaptability of him, the way that, you know, it's all about the team, and he's found himself in these positions. The run for the fourth goal against Stoke was just an absolute lungbuster. I mean, it was like, it was door to door, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Very reminiscent of Bobby Zamora's last goal for us against, I think it was against Huddersfield at the Amex, where he ran the entire length of the pitch to get on to the end of a similar ball. And then I don't think he kicked another ball in anger ever again. I think I had to bring the oxygen out, and that was his last goal. But obviously, João Pedro, slightly younger and fitter, is not so much of an issue for him. But he gets in position. He makes things happen. And like a lot of the penalties that he scored, it's just been him getting found in the box.
Yeah. He works incredibly hard. He gets through a lot of miles. He tracks players. He tracks back, and he makes bursting runs. We saw it against in all the build-up play to that Hinchinwood goal against Spurs. He did a very similar thing in creating the chance against West Ham, which unfortunately he then repeated what Pascal Grosch had done with his head in the first half and just put it straight towards the goalkeeper.
That was a poor shot.
Poor finish, bitterly, on that occasion. But those bursting runs, that energy, and obviously the space that then creates for other players is where it's at. I guess that's one thing Ferguson still
doing. I can't let this finish. Sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, sorry, go on. Yeah, I
can't let this finish without me contributing to the discussion about João Pedro, because I absolutely love João Pedro. The way, what you were talking about there, Russ, was his work rate is phenomenal. His running is just extraordinary, both on and off the ball. And that's kind of feeding into what you were just saying about him winning penalties and so forth and luck busting and that run across West Ham's defence that he did, which wasn't too dissimilar to the way in which he set up Hinchinwood for the first goal against Tottenham. But yeah, I absolutely love João Pedro. And you talk about his penalties. I mean, he's an amazing penalty taker. I still can't work out how he does it, but he's hit the wrong way. I think somebody's done some research on it, North Stand chat. I think it's something like 85% of the time he sends the keeper the wrong way. And the times where the keeper's gone the right way, he's hit it right in the corner hard and lifted it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a skill. As you said, they're all goals. And those aren't that easy to finish. Yeah, most of them you might score, but to score all of them, he scored, I think it's 13 out of 13, including the two friendlies for us and one or two goals here and there. He did miss one for Brazil, he acknowledged in an interview quite forthcomingly and honestly. But that's the only goal the only penalty he's missed at all. But yeah, I'm trying to study his method, and what he's doing suggests that he must be seeing the goalkeeper and then placing it the other way.
Yeah.
But I can't see him looking. I mean, I know
he's looking down when he connects with the ball.
Yeah,
he stares at the goalkeeper.
Yeah. So whether he's lulling the goalkeepers into thinking he's not looking at them and they can make a confident choice to go this way or that, I don't know. But it's certainly working marvellously for us. Even better ratio than Alexis McAllister. And I really feared, one of the biggest fears when he was sold was, who have we got? Because Pascal's record wasn't perfect. We didn't really have many other people. Danny Welbeck had taken pens, but he'd missed some anyway. I was wondering,
Milner's good at penalties.
Milner's, I don't think he's missed. He's not taken a huge number, but he always seems to score them, especially in shootouts, doesn't he?
The ball stays hit.
Yes, as they say.
When he kicks it.
He used to be Liverpool's penalty taker before Salah turned up. I mean, he used to score virtually all the time.
Yep. And The other thing is, set pieces have been an issue in both boxes in the past. One feature which is slightly improving is João Pedro's getting on the end of stuff at the right end. We've alluded to it earlier a couple of times in recent weeks. But moving the conversation on, someone else who I think might be good at set pieces, who we haven't signed yet, but very excitingly are on the brink of confirming, is Barco, the Boca Juniors player who has been described variously as a left back or a left winger or a left midfielder. Tim Vickery insists he is a specialist left winger who can play at left back. I think Andy Kay, you mentioned that he did originally play his games at left back before he broke in and played left midfield thereafter. More recently, he's been playing left back anyway. He's playing for Boca. There was a release clause of 10 million. And apparently today, as we speak, which is Tuesday, that release clause activates up to 14 million. So it's an interesting period of time. I'm not quite sure what's happened with that. But Tim Vickery, we've got him at 10 because, yeah, he was on Sky Sports News today. Interesting thing. He said everyone in Argentina has reported it's a done deal. This is before we heard that the medical is now going ahead, which is now the case. And yeah, apparently it was a case of if you can activate it at 10 million, or there was the option to have it at 9 million with a sell on of 10%. I'm not quite sure what the final dealings are, but that's the sort of ballpark we're talking about. And that is going to be a bargain because by all accounts, and according to Tim Vickery, he is a cracking player, very, very good, very, really talented. He's described as a red-headed flea by Tim today.
He did that in directly comparing him with Purvis, actually, and saying how different they were as players, because I think that's the way in which the question was composed to him.
I suggest he might be a replacement or something like that, didn't he? But that's not the plan for us anyway, not at the moment.
It's funny, I spent some time watching some Barco videos recently, and I see him playing further up the field than at fullback. I think he'll be a person that will play fullback if, like now, all the fullbacks are injured. But he's just a thrilling player going forward. But he can tackle.
Yeah.
And if you watch the highlight reels, like quite a lot of his tackles happen in the opponent's half. Some of them will be him tackling from behind, as well as doing the normal defensive tackles in front. So tackling is very much a part of his game. So even though I expected to play forward, he has defensive chops. He can tackle. So he could perform defensive duties, but he's got a really light touch on the ball. He moves and he gives and goes, so that he looks like a deserving player. He looks like a bang 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 player. So he wants the quick interplay and passing. He's got very good touch. Takes people on. He's very aggressive. Obviously, the Premier League, I think, is much more physical than the Argentinian league. So I think there might be, there's going to be an adjustment period for him. But he looks like a player that can cause utter mayhem in the opponent's half, as well as defend stoutly in ours. So I could even see him drifting into the middle. We don't have a defensive central midfielder at the moment. We don't have a lot of a breaker, someone that can break the play up. I could see De Zerbi thinking, well, we haven't got anyone else at the moment. How about I'll give you a run out there if I'm going to have Purvis and Mittimer on the left. We'll just chuck you inside a little bit and see how we get on with that. He looks like he could play all over the pitch, which I think is definitely going to appeal.
Roberto definitely isn't fully immersed in the notion of Baleba as a first choice regular starter yet, is he? I think he's alluded to that in a couple of interviews, and you can see by when he's been picked, he's not being picked as a default at the moment, notwithstanding anything going on behind the scenes where he's not available. But the other thing with Barco is we don't have, I think, a potent left-footed set-piece specialist. And Tim Vickery alluded to the notion that he can take a wicked free kick with his left foot as well.
His crossing is ridiculous.
Yeah.
This is the other aspect. His delivery is superb.
I suppose in terms of what you said, Andy, about where he could play, for instance, if he doesn't play left back, and I suspect that he may well fill in playing a little bit at left back to give Purvis a rest, for instance, et cetera, et cetera. But if he plays further up the pitch on the left, which is where I've seen him on kind of YouTube playing for Boca, then that's a left-footed player playing higher up, whereas normally Mismar plays there inverted. And Roberto's light inverted wingers thus far, not exclusively, because Adingra's right-footed and plays on the right. But he'd rather go with Mismar and Solly. I think there'd be his optimal kind of, but obviously the emergence of new players like Barke may well kind of throw that into doubt. It's similarly to what I was saying about Hinchelwood earlier. It would be interesting to see if he was deployed further in field, like you suggested there, Andy. All I'm, I suppose, saying is that I didn't get the fact that he was playing there on the YouTube clips for Boca.
I think he just naturally drifted inside on situations and then just won the ball back.
Mm-hmm.
So he just looks like someone that can win the ball in the middle. His best highlights are when he's playing on the left, because clearly that's on his proper foot. But he just seems to have a lot of possibilities, and he just seems to have a lot of energy. And the thing is that when you play lots of games, you need lots of options.
Yeah.
Not all of these players are starting every game, but they're probably going to play like half an hour.
Yeah.
At the very least, and there'll be situations. He looks absolutely thrilling as a prospect, and I can't believe. And I think the reason why we got him is because we're more likely to play him now. I mean, he's not going out on loan. He's going straight into the team.
Absolutely, yeah.
As he's done with the other 20, Argentine under-23 tournament or whatever they're playing.
You're obviously alluding to the fact City were lurking around as well. But again, it's one for the future as far as they'd be concerned, isn't it? Whereas he wants to, if he's coming here, he wants to get game time straight away. He doesn't want a token loan somewhere else. He doesn't want to sit around waiting. And that's where we've, in the past, and it seems in this case as well, have had the edge. It's amazing to think we can have an edge of any sort by going up against City, doesn't it? And it's only for...
He may well end up at Man City, but it'll cost a bit more than 8 million.
That's fine. That's the model, isn't it, for us and them. They pay a risk premium to sign players when it's already established and when they're already first team regulars. We ride through that risk premium. That's our modus operandi.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, on this, I would just add, the rumour about City was that they were actually going to loan him in straight away rather than go straight into the squad. But the other thing worth highlighting is, I gather, and that's just someone posting this information on to us, actually, in a group chat, that Ali Mack has put in a good word for him. And I still love Ali Mack. I really do.
Yeah. I do too. That's great to hear if that's true. Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah. In terms of, just to wrap up, I mean, in terms of injuries, we've still, by my calculations and notwithstanding any information we don't know about, we have at the moment Enciso, March, Mitoma, Adingra, Fati, Igor, Veltman and Lamptey out. I think it would be nice to sign a right back. Wanlu has been mentioned, the Sevilla player. And maybe longer term, we're thinking of maybe... we move Lamptey on and sign him. Maybe that's the plan longer term once Veltman's back from injury. Slightly eased injury crisis. I think it'll get a lot better for the fact we've got a bit more time to rest players up and get them back. Also, if we did sign Barco, of course, that minus is one off of the list in terms of, you know, it's another body available anyway. We have recalled some players from loans. Popium, we mentioned, came off the bench against Stoke, having been on loan in the first half of the season at Cheltenham, I think it was. Sarmiento was recalled from West Brom, but put out on loan to Ipswich, which is an upgrade because Ipswich have had a fantastic season, challenging for auto-promotion and possibly even the title. But in terms of other bodies coming in, just briefly, transfer window, etc. Apart, assuming Barco can be done, who else would you want? Would Wanloo be all you'd want?
I'm not one of these fans that wants Tony to spend his money because I kind of notice a gap in the squad or whatever. I mean, as I indicated, we were wingless at times, and that's just a fact. It's unarguable. We've struggled at fullback, but I suspect we'll be all right, and I'd be quite happy actually if we got Barco, and that would be bad in terms of our transfer activity, because in terms of injuries returning, Tony has said that all of them apart from March will be back by mid-February. I gather that fact his recovery is going a little bit quicker than expected.
By the time
we get back to the Wolves game, we've got 16 days rest. You know, we might have one or two more of those injuries back, and then we've got the Sheffield United game the following weekend, and then Luton, and then Palace, and then we've only got three more games during February. And I suppose one of my points that I wanted to make is if we're going to be looking up the table rather than down the table, I think we really need to capitalise on those games in late January and February in terms of the Premier League, because you go into the second half of March, we've got the two games in the Premier League that we played then, City and Liverpool, and that will be when we're playing Europa League games, whatever. So that will prove tough, those two games. So I want to try and get points on the table at the next six games.
Absolutely. I mean, the notion, though, at that period of time, having Barco, Mitoma, Fati and Ciso all in our armoury available would be...
That is a fine quiver and an even better set of arrows to start firing at the opposition. I mean, I think as regards to the transfer window, to be honest, I'm with Andy. If all we get is Barco, I'm not going to be unhappy about it. We can maybe add someone with a right foot because we seem to be deficient in that department at the moment. But I think Barco's going to be...
What do you mean by that? We've got loads of right-footed players.
Well, I think it's the cover. We've got players that can cover it. Get through it. But again, it's about this stretching of resource, isn't it? Not being able to rotate and rest players when we want because they're able to cover somewhere else. And instead of getting the rest on a certain game when we've got another option, they end up playing right back or something.
The position that I think we are short on is right attacker. Odinga plays there. You know, historically, Sonny has. Solly's going to be, I don't know if I said that, but Bloom said that Solly's going to be out for longer. Most people seem to think that he's out for the rest of
the season. So this is where I think Andy Mbaji from Copenhagen comes into play, which I don't know how serious the links are between us and him. For me, it seems like an unlikely signing, given he's actually quite high profile.
Great.
You would think that somebody else would come in and sweep for him, but if our interest is true, if our interest is real in him, that would strengthen us Moore. I think that would be a genuinely exciting one.
I
think we're a be a right club for him to develop as well. I think we're good at making exciting young players even more exciting.
Yeah, and he would fit the bill. And his name isn't really on the embargo for any listeners that don't know who we're talking about. He's a Copenhagen, exciting attacking wide right player, isn't he? Bargy is his surname. I'm not sure how you pronounce it, but I don't believe he's called Onion first name.
No, is it Rooney or something like that?
Yeah.
I apologise. I apologise to him for not researching how to pronounce his name properly.
Yeah, no,
but he's already got the nickname.
Yeah.
I mean,
I don't even think Bargy is how you pronounce his second name either. So we're being even crueler to him. But
I mean, I wouldn't turn him down. He looks really exciting player, but I agree with what Andy's saying. It's like his high profile. And I suppose two points going in slightly different directions. Firstly, they're still in the Champions League, and I don't know why they'd be looking to sell their best player.
I think it would be extremely unlikely that we would get over the line. I think we would have to work very hard to get this one over the line. But the prospect of it is very enticing.
It is. And going the other way is that Copenhagen aren't likely to get through the next round of the Champions League, where the natural order tends to impose itself once you get into the two-legged knockout kind of stages of things.
Yeah, true. Okay, gentlemen, I think that pretty much wraps it up, doesn't it? Any other burning questions or points you wanted to make before we finish off this episode? I think that covers it, doesn't it? It's been a pleasure chatting to you guys, as always. It's great that we've got through comfortably in this cup match. Sheffield United away in the next rounds. Very close to when we're playing them in the league, which is one of those typical quirks that happens with the cup draws, isn't it? But we look forward to that one coming up. In the meantime, thank you to Andy Kay. Thank you to Andy B. Thank you to Phil Annetts from earlier on in part one as well. And until the next time, stand or fall, up the Albion.
The Albion.
Up the Albion.
Sports Social Podcast Network.